Well, now we'll get a little more scientific. You know, we've talked about programmed nutrition, and we've talked about what this gene chip can do. And a little story behind our next speaker. He's expensive. You know, he's one of these guys that you have to trust. And so when we started into this programmed nutrition, there was one man who understood it. And that's our next speaker. And there was one man who trusted that that one man understood it, and that was me. So our chief scientific officer is Professor Carl Dawson. We feel very honored to have him on our staff and running our research literally around the world. We put about 14.5% of our gross revenues go into research. And I know that that money is well spent. And I know that that money is in good hands, and you will too, when you welcome with me Professor Carl Dawson. Carl?
Thank you, Pierce. Boy, do I feel out of place today. All these entrepreneurs up here, and they asked me to talk about science. So this is the boring part of the whole thing. You've got to listen to a boring professor talk about some of the neat science that's going on today. This is a real neat opportunity. The things that we're getting a chance to do is really changing the world today. And what I'd like to do for you in the next few minutes is describe why that system that Governor Brown is working. And the reasons for putting those types of systems together. A lot of this goes back to very basic biology. It goes back to the very beginning of what I learned when I was in a high school biology class and genetics, if you'd like. In the last decade, however, we've had more advances in science, in the molecular science, if you'd like, than we have probably in the past 200 years. We're learning a lot more about what's going on in terms of the basic molecular mechanisms. And that is where all of this started out when we talk about meat quality, the taste, the moisture content, tenderness. Those are things that we had an opportunity to look at and change using this type of technology. But it was this change in frontiers that we had that really changed what we wanted to do in terms of coming up with new product ideas and truly revolutionizing what we think is important in terms of animal production systems today. Now, genetics has always been part of what we do in agriculture, whether it was from breeding bulls to improve the meat quality, the reproductive performance, or whether it was due to breeding corn plants that have significantly higher yields. That was all based on what we knew about genetics and the breeding process overall. So what do we really know about genetics? Well, probably the biggest change in genetics took place in 2003. That's the year they completed the Human Genome Project. This was a tremendous advancement if you look at what was really happening. At that point in time, we actually sequenced all of the DNA. The tool, the map that determined what was going to happen in the human body was determined at that point in time. We knew exactly what the sequence was. This was a monumental change because we had about 3 billion different steps that we had to understand. We completed that. It was a major breakthrough in cost. It cost as much to do that project as it was to put 3 shuttlecrafts into space. It was about a 10-year project that took place. But when we were done, we knew exactly what the basic map was for the human being. Since that time, it's gone on. We've done a lot more with the sequencing idea, and we understand the genome of over 200 different organisms today. So there's no secrets down there at that level at what is coming from a piece of DNA and how that's being transferred on to offspring. The ultimate part of genetics was completed. We knew what was happening. We knew what the basic steps were. But time has marched on since then. Things have really changed in the last 10 years, and we're starting to realize that just because we know what that map is, we don't know what it's going to do every time. So you have to start asking a lot of, why is it that these things happen? The first example is one of twins. We have identical twins. Theoretically, these people have exactly the same DNA to start out with. But look at the difference in the structure of these two individuals. Environment played a big part of what happened to them. Their health aspects, their nutrition, all influenced what they could actually do. And you can see what happens. I always like to say that one of them's me and the other one's my brother. You can decide which is which if you'd like to. Here's another case, a Goody mouse. These are two mice that have identical genetic backgrounds. For all intents and purposes, the DNA in these animals are the same. They have the same map. But look at the difference in structure. One of these mice is going to be prone to obesity and will eventually have diabetes problems. The big one there, if you'd like. The other mouse is pretty much normal. And it wasn't what these mice ate that determined this characteristic. They're genetically the same now, but it was what the mother mouse ate that determined what these animals would do. A mouse that actually came from a mother that was given an appropriate vitamin mix comes out to be fairly normal. But if a gene gets turned on in this mouse by starvation or limiting nutrients to their mother mouse, you'll have this situation of obesity turning up in these mice. This was not a genetic change now. This is a change in what that DNA is going to do overall. Another example that's very common today, the idea of caloric restriction. Now, no matter what the genetic background for an animal is, your diet or that animal's diet will determine the way it ages. And this is an example of what can be seen in this particular area. Two monkeys, approximately the same age, but with different dietary regimens throughout their life. The one below received about 445 calories per day. The one above, about 885 calories. The difference here in the aging process is extremely significant. In fact, the longevity of these animals will be considerably different, with up to about 10 years different in the age that these animals will finally succumb to death. That's an amazing difference, and it's not because of the genetics of these animals. It was the environmental influence that turned on genes and turned off genes in that animal that determined whether it was going to actually age, if you'd like. Another good example that you'll see coming up, and it's very common today, we run into it when we talk to a lot of people who are children of women that were in internment camps during World War II. These women were actually programmed to do something different in their life with their genes as a result of nutrient restrictions during these periods of time. Many of these women left the internment camp underweight, but once they got into an environment where they had sufficient food, it changed their life completely. They were conditioned to low caloric intake, and when caloric intake went up, they started storing fat back. And not only that, the children of these women would also carry on that same characteristic, would tend to gain weight much more easily than one that had received a sufficient diet all of their life. That's a pretty amazing thing to happen, but it's not due to the genetics of that animal. It's the way the genes are actually being expressed in these animals, in this case, in these women. Now, here's an observation that's going around right now that's very important to all of us. How many of you know what your birth weight was? Were you heavy? Were you light? Do you know? That's a pretty important fact to know today, because your predisposition to a lot of diseases is determined by your birth weight. In fact, if you look at this particular figure, this has to do with glucose tolerance, which is a measure of diabetes, if you'd like. If you were born at a very heavy weight, you are much less likely to have diabetes problems. And this also carries on to a number of chronic diseases, including heart disease today. This is a process that the medical community is just now starting to understand. And there's a term that's being used for this. It's called developmental plasticity. The idea is it doesn't matter what the genes were, that you actually can have the same genotype, but have different types of physiological and morphological characteristics coming from that same set of genes. And this happens during the developmental process. Now, the one thing that was very neat from some of these observations is you cannot reverse the effects of that low or high birth weight effect. If you were born with a low birth weight, the tendency was to increase the birth weight by providing a lot of food immediately, trying to compensate in that birth weight. And as it turns out, this just amplifies the problem. The baby is very much conditioned at the time of birth, and unless you take advantage of a slow change, take advantage of that imprinting, you can actually accentuate the problem. And here's the last one, the problem of obesity. This is one that the medical community says, hey, we've got a real problem here. And you know what? It's being carried on from generation to generation. Heavy mothers tend to give birth to heavy babies. Heavy babies tend to give birth to, or grow up to give birth to heavy babies. And this is just spiraling downhill all the time. This is a conditioning process. It has nothing to do with the basic genetics of these individuals. It has to do with the fact that they are being conditioned to respond a very specific way. Now, some of this may seem to you to be obvious, but it's a very important tool as we start moving forward and start thinking about what's happening. And this was really listed as one of the 10 unsolved mysteries of science by Scientific American. How do genes actually respond to environmental activity or environmental factors? They call it a mystery, and if I look at the things that we've done in the last 4 or 5 years, I don't see much mystery to this at all. We are actually getting to the point where we can show you what these really look like. And the tool that allows us to do this is this thing called the gene chip. It is a system for allowing us to see what a gene does, what gene is turned on, which ones are turned off, how they're responding to the environment. Now, these gene chips are very cool because they don't just look at one or two genes. They look at the whole 30,000 gene set that's in a human body, if you'd like, or in our case, cattle, pigs, chickens. We can actually take a picture of that gene expression pattern and use that to understand what is going on in environment. And in our case, we're very interested to see what's happening with nutrition. It's these switches, then, that we're trying to understand. We're trying to use this gene expression pattern to determine which genes are turned off and which are turned on, and how we can regulate those switches in an animal. Now, that brings us to a term that's very common today that's being used in science a lot, is this idea of epigenetics. The epigenome is the next level up from your DNA, if you'd like. It's the next level of regulation. So if you'd like, your DNA draws the blueprint, but how you construct it depends on what screw went where, which nail went in the right board, how you put it together. Well, the epigenome is what determines what that looks like. just doesn't take what's on the blueprint. It determines what's turned on and what's turned off. And the thing that's important about this is that we can condition that. This epigenome is something that we can actually control, and it can become a very powerful tool for controlling what happens in an animal production system, if you'd like. These are effects that are cumulative over time. As you age, your epigenome becomes more important. I'm getting up there in age, so my epigenome is really starting to take over right now. Some days I'd like to turn that off too if I could, but I'm not going to get there. But it is that secondary level of control that we're just now starting to understand as we want to move forward. But the important fact is that we can condition this system, and we can imprint it, we can adapt it to very specific things. And that's the thing that we're starting to understand today, is that we can actually make those changes in the system. Now, what do we actually know about nutrition? Well, when I was at university, I taught a lot about nutrition. Is it very important? Yes, we know it influences what you're going to look like, how you're going to grow, the way an animal grows. But typically, if we talk about nutrition, we talk about dietary components. What's in the diet? And we have descriptors that we use for that. How much energy is in the diet? What type of energy is it? Is it metabolic energy? What kind of protein is it? What's the amino acid balance? Those are all things we talked about as chemical characteristics of what might be there. And you've all seen the food pyramid. In the United States, the USDA has their food pyramid. They've gone away from that now and actually have what they call My Plate, if you'd like, trying to describe what your optimal nutrition needs to look like. How many actually look at nutritional labels? Just about everybody actually will sit down and look at them. They may not know what they're reading all the time. Go and look at the caloric intake or caloric value, or they might look at the fat level, because we all know those are bad, or sodium. But that's about the knowledge we have of what nutrition really does. In the animal system, we have in the United States an NRC or a set of standardized tables that tell us what nutrients need to look like. We have a set of standards that can be used to evaluate animal diets. Now, these tables have been fantastic. They have really changed the way we view nutrition overall and have made some major advances in the way we produce livestock today. But they do not use all of the information that can be gained in today's technology. This idea of gene expression gives us a whole new level of understanding of what's going to go on in these systems. And the other important part about these tables is they fail to look at nutrient interactions. Your vitamin requirement is going to vary depending on how much fat you have in your diet. And these are often not taken into account if we actually look at the tables or standardized tables we use today. So there's a way that we can move this to another level. And that's the revolution we're going to talk a little bit about as we move forward now. Now, the big thing that we want to change this is, again, trying to use this gene expression pattern. And about 4 years ago, we decided we were going to try to come up with an antioxidant system. Remember antioxidants. We're going to come back to that again here in just a minute. Well, we're going to come up with an alternative to vitamin E, which is a standard antioxidant system. This was a great idea. I don't think it really got a lot of commercial value out of it, but it came up and gave us some ideas that we didn't ever have before. And that was that, in fact, we could replace all of the vitamin E in an animal's diet with materials that did not contain, or a complex of materials that did not contain vitamin E. Now, I wouldn't recommend this as a feeding program today. It's going to give you problems. But the fact was that we could actually say there was no vitamin E requirement in these animals. That takes those tables that I just showed you completely out of question here. You don't have a way to do that. Now, there are going to be a lot of things that have to change if we're going to ever get to this point where we're saying you don't have a vitamin E requirement. But there is a requirement for antioxidants, and maybe that's the direction we need to be moving with this kind of concept. But we did not necessarily meet that need just by providing vitamin E. Now, the other area that we're working with and have been for quite a while is this early stage nutrition. And in the chicken, this is a neat concept. It is the idea that immediately after hatching, a young bird is very susceptible to imprinting, if you'd like, conditioning of gene expression. It's during this initial period in time when, if you'd like, there's a lot of stem cell differentiation going on. The system is really vulnerable to being influenced by environmental factors. If we look that over here, that is a tool then that we can use to change what happens in a bird's life. And we've gone through a lot of this. If you were at last year's symposium, we talked a lot about imprinting of birds and what you might do with it. But here's the observation that's very important. If you actually take and look at this, you can actually show that these birds have totally different gene expression patterns. And that's what we've demonstrated here. If you'd like, this is a heat map. The colors represent whether genes turned on or turned off. But if you look at a conditioned animal versus an unconditioned animal, you'll find that they do not have the same gene expression patterns. Now, that's a pretty amazing observation, because now you're saying, look, I've changed this animal completely around. We are not looking at the animal that we started out with, and our imprinting process completely changed what this animal has the potential to do and the way it's going to use its nutrients at the end of the day. So, some of these changes are very permanent. Imprinting can be used to control things throughout the life, and those changes I showed you in gene expression were not during the period of time when I gave them this imprinting diet or conditioning diet. These were 21 days later into that bird's life. These are fairly permanent changes in what that bird is capable of doing. And if you were to look at these birds even after their 42-day production cycle, you'd find that their gene expression patterns were still totally different. So this is a permanent change that goes on within those birds. Now, that doesn't mean if you were to reproduce that bird, they would pass it on. It's not a gene change. It wasn't a genetic change in that animal. It was, in fact, this epigenome that we were changing in this system. So, now we have a new tool here. By imprinting, adapting, conditioning, whatever you want to call this at this point in time, we have nutrition becoming a process. It is not simply looking at formulation. It is a tool that's as powerful as some of the drug systems that we're using today. It is a system that's as powerful as the pharmacological approaches that are being used in some systems. And it comes from naturally controlling feed intake or application of specific nutrients in the feed. That's a kind of neat concept to start building on as we move forward. And we're not limited in when we do this conditioning. We talked about it in birds being that critical period right after the bird is hatched. You can actually imprint in utero. You're going to hear some papers here this week talking about in utero imprinting processes. You can do this by maternal imprinting, feeding the mother animal something that you want to influence what's going to happen in the offspring. You can do postnatal imprinting, which is essentially what we talked about with the young birds or early life nutrition. Or there are specific transition periods in an animal's life. So in beef cattle, the day they move from grass hay onto the feedlot in the United States, there's going to be a tremendous shift in what the physiology of animals have to be like. And during that period of time, we have the opportunity to change that. We're going to set up the animal or individual for a new type of activity. That's very neat. So, what are we going to use this for? In the food chain, this was the challenge we were given. What do we really want to know? Well, about 2.5 years ago, we were in a discussion with Yum Brands. Said, well, I think we were actually talking about support for the World Equestrian Games. Said, well, we have some things we'd like to have you build into our chicken. What would you like to have? And here are the things they talked about. Sensory, they want both fried and grilled sensory properties to be improved. Flavor, moisture content they like up. Olfactory factors, the smell, it must smell like a fresh bird. These companies would prefer not to freeze their birds if possible. Shelf life, not to be confused with spoilage. Bacteria get in the system, you don't have any choice. But the meat can be protected, and that's generally looking at antioxidants and nutritional enhancement of the birds. Can you do something to improve the nutritional value to the human when they... Now, this is a neat opportunity because it gives us a chance to use this imprinting to move forward. And that was the thing we went forward with. Now, it starts out, in our case, with antioxidants. We've been working with antioxidants for a long time. Now, antioxidant systems are exceptionally important. If you would like to look at yourself, what you're doing right now is having a battle between oxidants or oxidation systems and antioxidants in your body. And you know what? I hate to tell you this, but the oxidation side's going to win eventually. And if you can figure out how to stop that, then we'll all be immortal and we won't have any problems coming up. But this is the system that determines what the integrity of the meat product, what the integrity of the tissue is going to be like as it moves forward. We've been working with these a lot. We've been doing this for many years at Alltech, and we've actually set up a lot of gene expression work looking at what antioxidant systems can do. We know that we can change gene expression patterns. We have very specific gene expression patterns we can associate with specific antioxidants and fat levels in an animal's diet, and we can use that to help predict what's going to happen in the overall animal system. The role of antioxidants are very important in meat quality, though. This is an opportunity we have. They actually determine the structural characteristics of the meat. They influence the tissue integrity overall, the storage characteristics of the meat product, the flavors, the rancidity, if you like. They can protect against that, and they influence water retention. So we have a tool here, and we know what we're looking for because we have gene expression patterns to actually start looking at that. So nutritional imprinting gives us the opportunity to move forward with this. We can use this epigenetic control to try to make that change. So can we improve meat value or nutritive value, if you'd like? Can we deliver a product? And you've already had some exposure to this. I got a wonderful introduction a few minutes ago up here with people that have had some experience with this activity. By strategically changing nutrition, we can, in fact, influence beef products. We can provide this protection, if you'd like, the antioxidant systems. We can maintain moisture content, improve the meat color, lower pH, which is very important for beef cattle meat products. But at the level of the consumer, we can actually demonstrate improved tenderness, lower fat content. There's your nutrient value they're looking for. That goes with lower cholesterol content in addition. Improved flavor, greater consistency of a product overall. So we can start meeting some of these requirements that the industry threw at us and said, we would like to have you address. But the meat itself, well, it's a matter of taste. Where do you want to go with that? I always get a little bit nervous when we start talking about sensory evaluation of meat products. It can go a number of different directions depending on individual tastes and backgrounds. But we've actually done some comparisons, and Governor Brown showed you some things he'd done in an independent way. But we actually can show you that if you go to a chef or a restaurant chain, you can actually have them compare this. If we compare it to top-notch prime steak right now, it's going to come out looking very similar. But you know what? It's going to have less fat. It's going to have less shrinkage in it. And if everything goes right tonight, you'll get a chance to find out what the beef really looks like when you actually do that to it. Oxidation levels go down. We can prevent rancidities from taking place in this system. We can decrease cooking losses. And some of these get to be fairly significant. Some of the things we've seen to date, 12% less cooking losses. For someone like Kentucky Fried Chicken or Chick-fil-A, this is an important thing to think about because that's the profit margin there when we start preventing that loss. But we can actually do this in a way that is an all-natural feeding program. We're not suggesting using a bunch of drugs to do this. It's very much a strategic use of nutrients. It eliminates a lot of the pharmacological effects that are used today or pharmacological processes that are used today. It allows for a sustainable production system, if you'd like. In many cases, we can show that it's less expensive overall. And it does not necessarily have to be matched, but can be matched to specific genetics. So we're looking at maybe adapting specific programs to specific breeds of animals. But here's the story that it comes down to. It's time to go back to school. This is where the revolution comes from. We are no longer able to work with nutrition the same way we have in the past. Nutrition is going to change. It's not within all of our experiences today. We've got to go back and relearn some of the processes we thought were important. A lot of nutritionists are not using this technology yet. Reason why? Education. We've got to understand and learn how to use this in a good way. You're going to see a lot of changes in this area. The things we've done in the last 5 years have just amazed me because we're actually producing products today that I never thought we could get away with using simple nutritional changes. We have met the challenges the industry gave us, changing the quality of that meat product, meat quality, cooking characteristic, freshness, shelf life are all things that we've addressed. And this epigenetic component can be used for other things too. We can start looking at disease resistance, nutrient utilization patterns. What is the true nutrient requirement for an animal? Can we actually change that? We've actually demonstrated that in some instances today. Meat quality, yield can be improved. Reproductive efficiency is another area that we can just start to touch on with epigenetics. And another neat one is going to be looking at the epigenetic effects on behavior. Animal behavior is truly important to what an animal will do in terms of overall performance. I hope I gave you a little bit of an idea of where the science is going. There is a basis for what we were doing in terms of improving meat quality, and I think that this is going to be a very exciting area as we move forward. You're going to see more changes in nutrition, and I say this all the time, in the next 10 years than you have seen in the last century. Hope you get ready for that and are half as excited about it as we are as we move forward. With that, I thank you for your attention.